Hey everybody, it's JT. What is on your holiday meal shopping list? Well, I would suggest Painted Hills Natural Beef. It is some of the best beef in the world. And your friends and family will be thanking you for a long time if you serve Painted Hills Natural Beef for your holiday meals. And now you can buy it online just by going to PaintedHillsBeef.com. Use the code BBQNATION at checkout and save yourself 15% on your order. Give Painted Hills Natural Beef a place on your table this holiday season.
It's time for Barbecue Nation with JT. So fire up your grill, light the charcoal, and get your smoker cooking. Now, from the Turn It, Don't Burn It studios in Portland, here's JT.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Nation. That's the Barbecue Nation. I'm JT, high atop the radio world in the Turn It, Don't Burn It studios in Portland, Oregon. We welcome all of our affiliates on the Barbecue Nation show on the Envision Radio Networks and have some special stations down in Texas. Well, you know, you go to the grocery store, you walk down the meat aisle, and you pick up your ribeye or you pick up your sirloin, and you're just kind of taking everybody's word for it, that that's what it is. And most meat cutters cut the right thing for you. But today we're going to talk to Dr. Ryan Cox from the Meat Science Department at the University of Minnesota, and we're going to make sure you understand all these cuts and what goes into them and what comes off of them here on the Nation. Also, this segment is brought to you in part by Painted Hills Natural Beef from the heart of the Pacific Northwest. Beef you can feel good about. That's Painted Hills Natural Beef. So let's welcome Dr. Ryan Cox. Are you the associate professor or the boss hog now?
Well, my rank and title is associate professor. I'm actually the extension meat specialist here at the University of Minnesota.
That's a lot to put on a business card, Ryan.
Yeah. For guys like me, you get real specific into your disciplines, and it just ends up with a whole lot of title. But bottom line, I'm the meat guy for the U of M.
Okay. I was going to tell you a story, and I'll probably end up telling it to you after the air, but when I was in college, this is way more than a couple of weeks ago, I had to take a meat science class as an elective, and we had a bad experience with me and the football team in the meat science class, but I'll tell you that off the air. Anyway, give us a little bit about your background. You got your PhD over in Kentucky?
I did my bachelor's and my master's degree at Auburn University in Alabama in animal science and concentrating in meat science, and then finished up my education in Kentucky, PhD in animal and food science with concentrations in meat science specifically. So that's what kind of positioned me to take on this role here at the U of M more than 10 years ago now, where we get to work with everybody in the public as well as the university, supporting agriculture and talking about food. It's just been a lot of fun.
And you've got a big job. I was reading all about you. We've never met before, but you've got a big job explaining to people, especially civilians, that really don't understand the whole process of, you know, they may know that a cow grows up on the range or in the pasture, may even go to a feedlot, but what happens and how it gets graded and then how it ends up in the store, they don't really know that process.
Sure, and I think that's the biggest challenge we face today in agriculture in general, and certainly on our St. Paul campus where we teach agriculture, is understanding that, you know, probably 2-3% of our population actually works in food production and agriculture, might be familiar with that, but the large majority of our country doesn't quite understand all the steps that take place, all of the technologies employed, all of the people employed, all the resources that really goes into making their food.
Yeah, it does. So for your basic meat science class, what do you go over when you're a student? We're going to talk about how you deal with civilians, but when you're a student and you're going in for an ag degree, maybe ag business or animal science or whatever, what goes through that process?
So at our university, in the Department of Animal Science or the Department of Food Science and Nutrition at the University of Minnesota, you're getting a degree in those departments and you can specialize or focus in meat science. There are other universities where meat science is an actual major. That's not necessarily the case at our university, but each university faces it differently. It's a very science-based discipline, talking about a lot of biology and chemistry. It's fairly rigorous. I can say that meats people have a pretty broad background in lots of different scientific disciplines.
So they understand, like, the biology of, and the chemistry of when the meat actually breaks down, the muscle breaks down, the acids, the enzymes, and that whole thing.
Absolutely. And I think that both of our departments of animal science and food science really are driving towards meat science in reality. I mean, we start not necessarily with a steak, but we start with a calf.
Mm-hmm.
We start with a small pig and the genetics that goes into that, the nutrition, the incredible nutrition that livestock have now, production methods that we have, humane handling, all goes into meat quality. And then sort of in the food side, obviously, from beyond fresh meats, we're employing all sorts of non-meat technologies that are really food science-based. And so we've got a very robust system in our St. Paul campus of training very talented scientists that are able to sort of supply the meat industry.
So I got to ask you this as a personal type question, you know, maybe being a little condescending towards some things. How many of these different labeling programs where they say, okay, it's grass-fed, it's certified, it's this and that. I mean, I've got my own thoughts about that, but there's a lot of it, and I actually blink. Some of it is probably good. Some of it is probably a little more hype than others.
Sure, and we've got a population now that's very interested in their food. We try to be as transparent as we can. People are getting more specific in their requests. I think it's wonderful we're in a country where we have that freedom of choice, that we're able to do that. But oftentimes, marketing claims, labeling claims, et cetera, are misunderstood, might not understand exactly what they're saying, what they're claiming. There's the perception that something could be perceived as better or worse.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes, what we end up explaining is that those are just different things and really tend towards preference. If you're an organic customer, you identify with those traits. We don't necessarily discuss those in sort of the scientific realm in that, you know, are there actual differences in those products versus conventional, et cetera? People are buying more with their attitudes, I believe, sort of more speaking more with their dollar that way.
Oh, I think so. And I think that if somebody has got a thing for grass-fed, and of course my smart aleck answer is most beef is grass-fed, if not all of it. But, you know, if they don't want any feedlot finish on them type thing, that's fine. That's not something I would choose to do, but that's perfectly fine for them.
Yeah, and we do that a lot. I teach students a lot on campus, and they get tired of hearing me say that. But in science, we don't really say good or bad. We just say different. And that's a really good way of describing something like corn-fed beef and grass-fed beef.
Mm-hmm.
We oftentimes think of, you know, there's only one spot on that plate for either of those, when in reality, those are two different great products that can be enjoyed by the same person on different occasions. So there's room for all of us at the table. I say that a lot as well.
Pretty big table there, right? Yeah, but
it's going to be a real big table, especially around my house.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's all good. We are going to take a break, and we're going to be back with Dr. Ryan Cox from the Meat Sciences Department at the University of Minnesota right after this on Barbecue Nation. Don't go away. Barclays for your gold, silver, collectibles, rare coins, and high-quality jewelry. Barclays in Oregon, 503-982-2033. That's 503-982-2033. Barclays, buysellpawn.com. Hey, welcome back to Barbecue Nation. I'm JT. This week we've got Dr. Ryan Cox from the University of Minnesota in their meat science department. If you would like to email us, it's bbq at salempdx.com. Pretty simple. bbq at salempdx.com. And we'll be glad to answer any questions that you have. This show is going into syndication shortly, and we're pretty excited about that. Anyway, how would you best describe, Ryan, when you are explaining to people, especially civilians, the difference in meat grades?
Sure. And so grade is another good example of where people aren't necessarily familiar with the term and don't really understand that today, really the only meat that is graded and is something they would see would be beef.
Mm-hmm.
And they would see it as a quality grade. We actually have yield and quality grades for beef. And we have systems for pork and poultry as well. But the reality is, beef is the one that we buy by quality, meaning essentially that marbling. So fat is flavor, as much as we don't want to admit that sometimes. And so the more fat that is within a muscle, generally speaking, it will have an improved palatability score, you know, scientifically speaking. We're going to respond to it more positively. And so that's what the quality grading system does, is it describes steaks that have more or less of that fat within their muscle. And that's kind of the bottom line, the biggest sort of differentiator. And so you're buying quality, you're paying, hopefully you're paying for what you get, is the thinking there. Yield grading is really largely for the packer to understand the value of each carcass, how much meat is going to be coming off of those carcasses.
I know that, you know, one of the great, I'm not going to mention any names here of any retailers, but I always thought one of the greatest kind of marketing programs, I'm not going to say scams, oops, I said it, was, you know, here's a big chain of stores and they'd say buy beep, select, you know, and it was a select mm-hmm. grade. And for a lot of people, they say, oh, that's good. And I would be there, right. You know, going, I said, it's not that good. You might want to look over here. You know, if you really want to do something that's lovely, look over here at the choice, you know, but they right. don't, you know, select. I always thought it was a brilliant stroke of marketing myself.
It is, and I think that's where some of the confusion comes in the meat industry, is we don't use quantitative types of describers or descriptors. Prime choice, select, standard are just very positive words.
Right.
But they're actually a ranking, prime choice, select, standard. If you hear something that is standard meat, you would imagine that it is good. It is what you would expect, standard meat. But that's actually the lowest grade within the young cattle that are graded. So yeah. There is a lot of culture there. There's a lot of tradition that kind of goes into that as well.
Well, I always kind of said, you know, prime choice, select, and prison grade is the way.
Or no roll. They're not going to bother to roll it with the pin because there's really not going to be much to sell there as far as value.
Right. So what is one of your classes for a civilian that's just interested in meat and you know, they want to get better at their cooking skills, but they want to understand it more? What do you go through in teaching them?
Well, in my role at the university, my primary job is to provide extension programming. So essentially the university space to the public. And so I actually do a number of workshops. I've got an evening course where we teach people that's converted to an online course now about general meat science. We've got a deer hunters workshop where we teach deer hunters how to field dress cleanly, make their own sausage, et cetera. But largely now, a lot of the popularity is drawing around our barbecue workshop, and that's our partnership with the Minnesota Barbecue Society.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had that partnership now for 7 years. We put on the barbecue spring training on our campus, which is a very unique one-day workshop where it's a partnership between the University of Minnesota, the Minnesota Barbecue Society, the Minnesota beef and Minnesota pork, and we put that on. It's great every year. It's gotten to where it sells out every year at 100 participants. I've had some great keynote speakers. So it's a really exciting time in a lot of our programs now as they're reaching maturity and really starting to reach a lot of audiences.
Is it similar to the one they do? I mean, they've got a brisket one down at Texas A&M. Is that kind of a similar type program?
Sure. And so my familiarity with that program and having heard from those instructors at some of our national meetings, that is a program somewhat like ours. That is a multi-day program generally.
Yes.
Enrollment is a little bit different process, and they may sort of drill down in specific cuts. Our barbecue spring training workshop is open to the general public. I would say we generally have about half of our crowd might be competitive teams, maybe a third of our crowd might be a competitive barbecue team, and then the other half or the other two-thirds would just be your sort of casual backyard griller learning, just wanting to learn more about food and meat. So that's kind of the unique position we're at here in the Twin Cities, and having sort of this urban market is we really have a broad type of audience and lots of people loving to cook meat on the grill.
Sure.
Or obviously barbecue.
What's one of the greatest misconceptions that you correct in your classes, especially for the weekend warriors?
For the weekend warriors that get real excited about stopping points, real specific temperatures, pink rings, things of that nature, I think the real driving point here, number one, is that there's no magic bullet when you're trying to get perfect in cooking in your backyard or cooking competitively. I also work with sausage makers and ham makers that are competing on the international level. It gets back to fundamentals. We get real worried about smoke rings, especially in barbecue, or holding a certain temperature for a certain period of time. But really understanding a slow cooking rate is really all it comes down to, in my mind. And I constantly am drawing out a time and temperature graph for my students, talking about how steep a heating curve can really damage a protein. So knowing your parameters and having a very slow, controlled cooking process.
I got to tell you, and I'll probably get in trouble from some of the listeners on this. I always thought smoke rings were overrated myself. So,
well, they are an indicator of picking up a certain amount of volatiles in the smoke, et cetera, but those are things that can be counterfeited, unfortunately.
Yes.
And don't necessarily indicate or really speak to the actual flavor of the smoke, only that those volatiles were present. And I can actually achieve a smoke ring by putting meat behind the tailpipe of a car. So that doesn't really tell me much.
Probably doesn't taste very good, though, does it?
No, definitely not. I think that kind of shows us the wide variety of what a smoke ring would actually give us. It's visual and that it's great. It makes the product very appealing, but isn't the bottom line. And I think I see that a lot, people looking for that.
Well, and I always thought it was one of those things when a lot of this stuff started, meat science wasn't what it is today,
Sure. And just a quick nod to ourselves at the University of Minnesota. The University of Minnesota was the very first university in North America to sell the idea of the phrase meat science. We had the first meat lab in the country. It was built in 1901 by Andrew Boss. And so he was really the person that sort of formalized meat science instruction. And so as a science and as a discipline, 1901 is not that long ago. So you're absolutely right. More and more understanding of this stuff is really it's a really exciting field.
Absolutely. We're going to take a break here on Barbecue Nation. We're going to be back with Dr. Ryan Cox. He's pretty into the animals, I can just say that. Right after this, don't go away. It's Barclays for your gold, silver, collectibles, rare coins, and high-quality jewelry. That's Barclays in Oregon, 503-982-2033, 503-982-2033, at BarclaysBuySellPawn.com.
Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz? My friends all drive.
Hey, welcome back to Barbecue Nation. It's my privilege to have Dr. Ryan Cox with us today from the Meat Science Department at the University of Minnesota. This portion of Painted Hills is also this portion of Painted Hills. How do you like that? This portion of Barbecue Nation is brought to you in part by Painted Hills Natural Beef. From the heart of the Pacific Northwest comes a beef product you can feel good about. And my friends down at Barclays in the North Valley there, they have collectible coins, silver, and gold. If you haven't spent your tax refund, give Barclays a call down there. They've got all kinds of cool stuff for you. So that's Barclays down in Woodburn. Also, if you'd like to listen to us on SoundCloud, it's Barbecue Nation. You have to spell it out, not just the initials. Barbecue Nation with JT. And if you've got a question, it's bbq@salempdx.com. All right, we've been talking with Dr. Ryan Cox from the Meat Science Department there at the University of Minnesota. You guys aren't the Gophers, are you?
We are indeed the Golden Gophers.
I knew that. I was just, a friend of mine probably 30 years ago, gave me a Golden Gopher baseball cap because he was an alumni there. He's no longer with us, and I still have that hat. So there you go.
Fantastic.
Yeah. When you get to cutting meat, you know, it's... I don't even really know how to phrase this properly, so I'm going to give it a shot. A lot of meat that comes into the big stores now is pre-cut in boxes. Very few large chains come in and have a carcass or a half a carcass hanging on a hook. Okay, but kind of run through the process of how the butchers, if they're in fact still come in, you know, on hanging on a hook, how they select their cuts, where do they end, where do they start? You know, you don't get a bunch of ribeyes out of the front shoulder.
Sure. So we've gone and taken what a lot of people in their minds have thought of this traditional butcher, where they're taking a carcass and breaking it down into all the pieces and parts and marketing every single one of those. And that used to be the case in small processors. However, that person has been replaced by a packing plant. And by that, I mean we're processing the live animal to the carcass there, but also that is being essentially portioned out to all the different cuts, and those can be boxed separately. And so boxed beef or boxed pork makes it possible for you to only receive ribeyes or only receive strips. And so that certainly revolutionized our industry a number of years ago, obviously, with the interstate system and how we've changed distribution, et cetera. So when we say that we're cutting a carcass down, that's a job that's done by maybe 100 different people, as opposed to what used to have been one or two different people. So that gets to the marketing. Everything is graded in the beef plant with pork. We know that we can sort for things like hams of different color, certainly loins, roasts, et cetera. But again, that job of one or two people is now done by literally hundreds of people in a packing plant.
I know. Well, the sponsor I just read about, Painted Hills Natural Beef, I've been working with them for a long time now as a spokesman and doing marketing and stuff for them. And people will ask me, they'll say, "Hey, can I buy a half a beef from Painted Hills?" No. You know, you could buy a box of, like you said, strips or you know, tenderloins or whatever you want, but I can't get you a half a beef in a box type thing.
Sure, and that's one of the really wonderful and unique things about our small processor culture here in the United States, and I can especially say in the upper Midwest where we are. We've got a very strong culture of small meat processors, of sausage makers, meat curers, a lot of German culture over here, a lot of Scandinavian culture here. So just a lot of that. And so you do have opportunities now that there, again, an increased interest in our food supply. People are working with smaller processors. And you can buy a whole side of beef or a quarter of beef, et cetera. And it's great. And that's certainly the case in other states as well, just depending on where you are.
So what's your favorite cut of beef?
The one that's on my plate, I always
say. There you go.
Because it landed there.
Yeah.
I like a lot of different cuts of beef or pork or poultry or any of those things for different reasons. My go-to sort of steakhouse cut goes back and forth between the strip and then the ribeye. I went ribeye for years because of the flavor. It does tend to be a little fattier. But more and more now, I tend to find a lot of appreciation in sort of these lower-valued cuts or what used to be considered lower value cuts. I love skirt steak, which is diaphragm meat, but there's just such a brilliant, intense beef flavor to that. It comes in at a reasonable price, even with demand for it. I like that one, and I really love the flat iron. I think that the flat iron is probably the most versatile steak in a beef carcass, and really the shoulder steak in a pork carcass is the same in my mind as far as versatility. So I don't have sort of the typical answers you'd expect. I like sort of inventive ways of using lower valued cuts.
I like Terrace Majors.
Oh, sure. The Terry's is certainly an interesting one that came along popularity-wise about the same time as the flat iron. The flat iron is the one that's gotten the most success.
Yeah.
But of all those new value-added cuts they've named, the Terry's Major, interestingly, is the one they just left it as its muscle name.
Yeah.
Whereas others got fancier names.
Yeah. You know, because I, up until a few years ago, I really hadn't had a lot of experience with it, and I was doing these huge tailgate parties down at the University of Oregon when I was with another radio group. And Will Homer over at Painted Hills said, "Why don't you try some of these Terrace Majors?" And I was like, "Okay." He goes, "I know you know what they are, but you probably don't know what they are by the name." And I said, "Well, listen, pal, it's been a long time since I've been in a beef science class, you know."
All right.
So he gave me a box of them, and I pulled them out. And I'll tell you, I had more people fooled, honestly, thinking I was serving them fillets.
Sure.
Because of the way I trimmed it and cut it. It's a shoulder muscle, you know.
Yeah, and I think that's what I try to convince a lot of consumers about, is I like the inventive ways of using lower valued cuts. Terry's Major is not necessarily lower value, but it was a great way to put more value in the carcass.
Sure.
Whenever we do that, we're only driving down the price of the other cuts. So it's great to see something like the Terry's Major or the other cuts that have been... So we've tried to innovate a trade that is so old and is so steeped in culture. It's really exciting when things like that happen.
Do you ever get involved on the economic side in your course, meaning that, like, you know... If you check beef prices and future prices like that, and if they're, you know, if they're a 5 cent difference between Monday and Tuesday or Wednesday, it can mean a fortune to some beef producers.
Oh, absolutely. And that's not necessarily my area, but certainly within my department in animal science, we have people that work in that. And then also ag economics, we have that on our campus as well. A big part of the deal. In our lab, we're really just kind of looking at the product itself.
Sure.
But our campus is really looking at that product holistically from really every angle.
Yeah, that's kind of tough because I'm always on the producer side. Sorry, retailers, but I am, because that's how I grew up. You know, I grew up on a farm. And I look at it and I read the market prices and stuff, not as much as I used to. And I kind of know that, well, they're selling this for $15.95 a pound over there. At, you know, brand X retailer, and I know they paid $7.45 a pound for it. You know what I mean? So you can't say you're losing money. So anyway, they can't. The rancher and farmer probably could, but
yeah, it's difficult to describe in margins. We get that question a lot on a smaller scale, sort of that misunderstanding as to what of a steer or a heifer can be eaten.
Yeah,
and going through, you know, bone and loss and gut loss and hide loss and all those things. Really, that 5 cent difference is make or break for a lot of companies. So, but definitely a very nuanced discipline in science, and really interesting the chances I've gotten to hear on that topic.
Ryan, we got a couple minutes before we got to go to break, so let's step back to that just for a second. What percentage of a carcass can really be used? I mean, just, you know, the hide and tallow somewhere else, but, you know, let's just talk about the meat and bone part.
Sure. So I'll use 1,000 pounds as a really generic number, and that's really low. We're putting cattle through plants that are 1,400 pounds plus.
Sure.
But if I have 1,000 pounds, generally cattle are going to dress about 62 to 64%, meaning we're going to cut off everything in the slaughter process that we don't want to eat to begin with, and that's head, hide, gut, feet, et cetera. And so essentially 64 or 640 pounds, best case scenario, goes into the cooler. That carcass is going to cool. When it cools, moisture leaves that carcass, which has a weight, 8 pounds a gallon. And so we'll see about a 3% loss there. And then that carcass, depending on how it grades, and we use our yield grade system in beef to do this,
mm-hmm.
about half of that is going to be meat. And the other half is going to be bone and fat that we don't want to eat. So if I go from a 1,000-pound carcass generically, you're in the 300, maybe 325 to 350 pounds of beef. It's actually something you can consume.
Yeah, that's a huge net loss, really.
So then we see all of the different values of the byproducts, and really that's where the packer really can make or break their business based on values of hides and values of organ meat and trade overseas, et cetera. It really is a small margin type of business, but it's hard to see on such a massive scale when they're trading 20,000 pounds at a time, really how tight those margins are.
Oh, yeah. It's tough out there. It's tough. We're going to take another break here on The Nation. We're going to be back with Dr. Ryan Cox from the University of Minnesota right after this. Get that grill fired up, man.
Oh, Lord, won't you buy?
Barclays for your gold, silver, collectibles, rare coins, and high-quality jewelry. Barclays in Oregon, 503-982-2033. That's 503-982-2033. BarclaysBuySellPawn.com.
Busted flat in Baton Rouge, waiting for a train
A nice feeling near as faded as my jeans.
Welcome back to Barbecue Nation here on the Envision Radio Networks. And our friends down in Texas, we want to say hi to. We made a new friend today, Dr. Ryan Cox from the University of Minnesota. Go Gophers.
And go Gophers.
Go Gophers. What's your greatest gratification? I mean, you've helped develop this. Like I said, we have not really actually talked until today, but I've did my homework on you and stuff. But you've helped build this program last few years. You've really gotten into it. So what's your greatest satisfaction of the program right now?
Campus, sure. Professors on campuses often commonly talk about that light bulb moment. And I think that's still the case with myself. A little different during, in my role in extension. I don't teach as many students on campus, but I do work a lot with companies that are processing meat, sausage makers, farmers, the public. And any time that I'm able to show someone why they've been doing something for 20 years, and you see that light bulb go off, I think that's terribly gratifying. When you see a gentleman who's been making the same type of sausage for 25 years and doesn't know why we're adding a certain ingredient, or we've got a farmer that's raising animals a certain way and didn't really understand what it is that we're... Those are the moments. Those are the moments that we really enjoy because we feel like we've helped someone and showed them something that we enjoy thinking about and talking about.
That's one of the reasons I like doing this show, Ryan, is because sure. I can cook pretty much anything anybody can cook on television because I do cook on television. And, yeah, I've got sure. that skill set. But I'm always interested to hear what other people have to say if you add this or you lengthen or shorten the cooking time or you do something to whatever it is you're doing. I find it really fascinating. And I've actually, incorporated some of those things that I've heard and learned over the past few years into what I do.
Oh, sure. It's an ongoing process. I'm a student. I consider myself a student until we're done. But really, I learn as much from my audience as I do when I go there. It's very engaging. You're always doing something different in my role, and I really enjoy it.
What's the one of the kind of atypical questions you get a lot from your students?
We get a lot of questions about where weird cuts come from. They've heard something where, their grandpa used to say there was this cut. They didn't understand where it came from. The reality is a lot of slang gets used in those phrases. So those are some of the stranger questions. Some stranger questions about really misunderstandings about agriculture in general, about how animals are trained or raised rather, and they're held. Those can be very bizarre when you've got a background and you've spent so much time in your career in animal science and some of these perceptions are just really surprising that people would believe that. So it never fails to. And today's internet age, it's going to continue to be the case. I'll never fail to be surprised on some strange thing I see there.
Well, if it's on the internet, Ryan, it's got to be true.
It's got to be true to somebody.
Yeah, it's interesting. Over the years that I've had discussions and debates with people, all with a lot of civility and stuff. But when I've heard them say that beef cattle are mistreated. So on, so forth. And they pick out one thing that they saw, that famous video of that crippled dairy cow that they were moving with a bucket on a tractor about 15, 20 years ago. That thing still makes the rounds about twice a year. And
very much so.
Yeah. And that's really not the way it is overall,
And a lot of that's driven by emotion. We have a lot of emotional appeals that are made and to sort of broad audiences, which doesn't really land with folks in our world, analytical minds, things about the science behind things.
Right.
We just have this tendency to not necessarily get mad anymore, but really just to jump up and want to educate and show people, no, that's not the case, but you'd really be surprised how normal this is and how interesting this is.
It's, when you take the emotion out of things like that and you're trying to cure the myths and the legends, so to speak, some of the myths and legends are actually true, but most of them are not. And in my experience, it's great when somebody like you and your team can set the ship on this right course, so to speak.
Yeah, we really enjoy doing that.
So we are going to get out of here, but if you're going to stick around, we're going to have Dr. Ryan Cox with us on the After Hours show, but I'm running out of airtime here for the regular show. So you can check that out on SoundCloud too. But Dr. Cox, thanks for being with us here on Barbecue Nation.
thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
No problem. We'll be back next week. Remember my little piece of advice I tell you every week, turn it, don't burn it. And we're going to have some fun stuff coming up in the next couple weeks. So until then, have a good weekend and go outside and cook something.
Busted flat in Baton Rouge, waiting for a train, and I was feeling near as faded as my jeans. Bobby thumbed a diesel down just before it rained and rode us all the way into New Orleans. I pulled my harpoon out of my dirty red bandana. I was playing soft while Bobby sang the blues.
Barbecue Nation is produced by JTSD LLC Productions in association with Envision Networks and Salem Media Group. All rights reserved. Copyright 2019.